Well, hey, everybody. It's Kevin Stevenson. Thanks for joining me on this week's episode of I Don't Care with me, Dr. Kevin Stevenson. It's a little bit different this week, guys. I'm being interviewed on my own podcast. It's crazy. I don't know how I feel about this, but I'm going to let it fly. My good friend David Kemp from Market Scale, he's got a great podcast over there called Highway to Hell. He wanted to interview me, and I'm like, sure, let's do it. So, David, welcome to I Don't Care.
What's up, everybody? It's David. I'm your host of Highway to Health podcast. If you've paid attention to this podcast in the past, you know I'm excited. I'm honored to host the people, the organizations that are doing everything they can. They're committed to improving access, experience, and outcomes for our patient population. Today I am joined by an executive, an experienced leader in healthcare. He's been doing it for 36 years. Dr. Kevin Stevenson has been one of the biggest, one of the best experts in this space. I'm excited to have him on. You're going to learn a lot from him. Dr. Stevenson, welcome to Highway to Health.
Hey, thanks, David. Drop the doctor. You know it's just Kevin. It's fun.
Man, if I had doctor on my name, I'd want everybody to say it. So, well, man, thank you for being here. You have been a part of healthcare in the most formative, transformative eras in our industry. And today I'm excited to learn, you know, what you've experienced, how things have changed, but also what you've seen stay consistent over the last 36 years. And I'm excited to dive in, and thank you for being a part of this.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, David. Really looking forward to this.
You look good too.
You know, I wanted to match the vibe of Highway to Health. I mean, you put your shades on. I had to go find mine. You know, the future's just bright, so bright, I got to wear shades, man.
You got that right. It is bright. And that's why I'm excited about this conversation. We start Highway to Health the same way every time. Now, you've been in healthcare for a long time. You've seen patients come and go. You've seen trends. You've seen fads. But a guy like you, you know, you've implemented some things in your life that help you maintain your physical and your mental well-being. What's a habit that you've added to your routine?
You know, I think something, David, that I tried to do throughout my career was just to try to manage stress as best as I could, because healthcare is a really stressful industry. And so really tried to stay grounded in my faith, and really tried to make sure that I prioritize my family life too. Hey, we work long hours in healthcare, but you've got to make time for yourself. You've got to make time for your family, and certainly make time for your faith, and just get away from it for just a little bit. It helps you recharge, and it helps you stay focused on the tasks at hand. I took my paid time off every year. You know, there are a lot of people that, you know, when they retire, they could have retired 3 years before because they had so much vacation. I never did, because I knew that if I wasn't at my best, I couldn't be my best for my people.
Yeah.
So I always take the vacations, stay strong in your faith, and stay connected with your family.
That's well said. Yeah. God, family, country.
Yeah. Good. Amen, brother.
Good structure. Amen. Especially right now in the times that we're living in. So,
boy, no kidding.
I appreciate you sharing that. You became CEO of the system at a really young age. And am I correct? Is my research accurate? Youngest CEO?
Yeah, of that company at that time. You know, and David, I just kind of stumbled into it. You know, I started my healthcare career on the business development marketing strategy side in the physical rehabilitation space of post-acute care. And was brought over to a company at the end of 1995 as director of marketing. And so got over to this 60-bed hospital, and we were able to do some really great things, had a great team. You know, we stayed full, you know, back then. Hey, volume cured all sins back then. So if you had heads and beds, everything was great. Well, we had heads and beds, but we delivered care really well. And we made a lot of money for the organization. And so I get a call one morning. I'm on my way in. And when my people call and said, oh, my gosh, you're not going to believe this. I said, what? She goes, I just heard on the radio that we're being bought out by our number one competitor. And I said, Okay, that's interesting. Hang tight. I'll be there in about 10 minutes. We'll talk further about it. I'll talk to our CEO. And so we went in there and I kind of talked to everybody off the ledge. Said, you know, everything's going to be fine. And all the time in my head, I'm like, you know, what's going on here? So the CEO, he and I are talking. He said, hey, I got a question for you. I said, what's that? He said, well, corporate has asked me to ask you if you would be willing to take a CEO job in Central Kentucky at one of the smallest hospitals we have. And I was 35. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing. And so, but I knew to develop my career, that was the role I needed to take. And so, and I knew it was going to be short term because anytime a new company comes in, most of the time they're going to be looking for their own leaders and their own style of management. And so, but I talked to my wife and she grew up in a household where they moved around a lot. And she said, hey, let's go. And so I had the support of my wife and my girls and we went to Central Kentucky. Here I'm a 35-year-old CEO going, what the heck am I doing here? But yeah, that's how it happened.
That's incredible. And the support of your family is everything. I've been a journeyman as well. My dad was military. We moved around every 2 or 3 years. And if your family's on board, you can do just about anything.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, throughout my career, I got accused of being in the military a lot, David, because you know, we would move around every couple of years because recruiters would call and the kids were little. It's like, why not? You know, new adventures. But I'd say, no, I'm not in the military, but it's healthcare. And it's almost like that. So
it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, for sure. So at 35, you're the CEO of a health system.
Well, it's one hospital, not a hospital.
I'm sorry. Right. Of a hospital.
Yeah. I don't want to make it bigger than it sounds.
Hey, you'll be the first on this show, not to make it bigger than it sounds. Okay. That's a good place to be. So you've held many different roles, during your career in healthcare. As a part of those roles, I mean, what have you learned about, you know, how these systems, how these facilities, how these providers operate? What have you seen over the course of the last 36 years that has stayed consistent, but may, you know, also share what you've seen change drastically over that time?
Yeah. And David, you know, while I've been in hospitals and health systems most of my career, I took a couple of interesting turns too. I did consulting early on for a while. I worked for a healthcare design build construction firm in strategy and client relations. I even worked for a large pharmaceutical distributor in generic pharma strategy. And I ran a physician network in ACO, but all of it, you know, supported hospitals and health systems in one form or fashion. Yeah, like I said earlier, back in the old days, volume cured all ills. Because the more people you had in your hospital, the more money you typically brought in. We did everything we could to bring people into the hospital, not only in the post-acute setting, but in the acute care setting as well. You know, fill the hospital, fill the beds, you're going to be doing great. Well, that's changed so much, you know, throughout, you know, the managed care era, now into value-based care, because, you know, reimbursements continue to shrink. Medicare and Medicaid programs continue to shrink. Of course, your managed care organizations are trying to maximize their shareholder value. So they're paying hospitals, health systems, providers less, you know. And so you have to be a lot more efficient today. And you've got to find ways to deliver that excellent care that you've always delivered in different ways. And that's why I'm really excited about, you know, things like AI. You know, how is AI going to continue to impact healthcare and impact the efficiency of health systems? And so I think that's been really one of the big changes that I've seen throughout my career. That and really the consumerism of healthcare. Because early on, you know, if you had a hospital, people were going to come to you, right? But more competition came about. More hospitals were built. People started realizing, hey, I've got choice. And so then the hospitals had to position themselves to be that provider of choice for, you know, all things or maybe something narrow as women's services or cardiology or something like that. So you really had to pay more attention to how you delivered the care. Not that you weren't delivering quality care, but it was the how of the delivery of care. And so you had to really focus on your customers, whether it be the patient, whether it be your medical staff, your employees,
right,
you know, the community, all of those constituents. You really had to focus on strategies, how to better serve them so that they would make your hospital their hospital of choice.
Yeah. When you talk about consumerism, you immediately think about the patient and the choices that they have. Something we think less about is, well, with more choices for the patient, more choices for your staff too. And there's a battle there. There's a competition there for just resources and personnel and talent in these health systems and these facilities.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there was a real fear of the nursing shortage before COVID even hit.
Yep.
In some of my early I don't care episodes, I talked to national nursing leaders and they all said the same thing. You know, nurses are leaving the bedside because it's hard work, because they have other opportunities in administrative roles, or they're just leaving the profession altogether. I had a nurse leader tell me early on in COVID, she said, you know what? Nurses are very loyal people. They're loyal to their patients, but they're loyal to their colleagues, and they're not going to bail out during COVID. But after that last wave that your community saw or would see, give it about 3 to 6 months and you're going to have a void in nursing. And boy, she was dead on.
Yep.
You know, that last wave here in Central Texas, about 3 to 6 months later, you know, we went from having, you know, more than enough nurses to handle our beds to scrambling through either contract labor or honestly, many hospitals have to close beds down because they didn't have the staff to care for the patients.
It's almost like they were there through the thick and the thin. And then once they felt like, okay, I've answered the call, I've got the community and the facility through these hard times, it's back to status quo.
Mm-hmm.
I've done, and they almost burnt out. You know, it's almost like they had to tap out for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, David, it wasn't almost burnout. It was total burnout because, you know, I've got the greatest amount of respect for nurses and all clinicians, but particularly nurses. You know, the only reason somebody is in a hospital is for 24/7 nursing care, right?
Yep.
So nurses are driving the success of the hospital, and it's hard work.
It really is.
And it's hard physically, emotionally, you know, mentally. It's just hard, hard work. And with everything being thrown at nurses now, from a documentation standpoint and from a safety standpoint and you know, patient experience standpoint, there's so many things that they have to think about while they're caring for that patient. And then, you know, we can also talk about expanding nurse ratios. You know, back in the day, one-to-one care in ICU, man, that was the gold standard. Now there are some ICUs that are doing 1-to-3, 1-to-4.
Right.
Which gets into a real hazy area of quality of care.
Yep. Which then, you know, not only makes their job harder, but, you know, the risk goes up because mental fatigue, you only have a certain number of mental, you know, brain calories to burn.
Yeah.
And when you spread that across 3 or 4 ICU patients,
that's
when mistakes happen. And then the nursing community gets blamed for it, and that's unfair.
Yeah.
The hospital gets blamed for it, and that's unfair. But yeah, I saw something the other day that, you know, by I think it was early 2030s, we'll be 750,000 nurses short of where we need to be.
Yeah.
That's only 5.5 years away, 4 years away.
Absolutely. Well, and it was exacerbated by a lot of things, obviously, you know, pre-COVID shift to more administrative or clinical type care, standard 8-to-5. And then the difficulty that arose during COVID when people started realizing how hard the nursing at the bedside is. But then you've got that generational shift. And no offense to younger people, my kids are of this generation, but they want a work-life balance that old people like me really didn't, that wasn't the top priority, you know, on a generational basis. individual basis, absolutely. But generationally, it wasn't.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the younger generation wants that work-life balance. They want to, they're willing to give up position. They're willing to give up pay to make sure that they have that balanced life, and good for them. But what that does is that limits that workforce even more.
Yeah, it does. And that kind of talks to, or, you know, lends itself to what you just discussed, you know, volume in our health systems and our hospitals was key, you know, years ago. Now, for a lot of reasons, and the staffing shortages being one of them, reimbursement being another one, there's more of a focus on efficiency,
yeah,
and keeping people out of the hospital, population health, value-based care, like you discussed, which leads to what happens when you're looking to become more efficient, when you're looking to be, you know, to streamline and increase bandwidth, you start looking for partners, you start looking for solutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've sold to hospitals and health systems. It's a hard thing to do because money's tight. Leadership, everybody wants a say in it. What have you seen, in your different roles and in your experience, what have you seen as a consistent, you know, almost trend or standard in the decision-making process at health systems and hospitals? Where does that influence lie? And what do you think might be the best structure or the best format to make decisions, you know, on what partner to bring in, what vendor to bring in, what solution to bring in at a hospital or a health system?
You know, David, like you, I've been on both sides of the equation. And it is hard to get into a hospital, but as a hospital C-suite person, we get bombarded every day,
yep,
you know, by a vendor of, you know, different services, different, you know, different inventory items or whatever. And there's only so many hours in the day. And when you boil everything down to, we're trying to take care of patients. And so we want to make sure that we're doing that to the best of our ability. And so sometimes, you know, I saw so many different solutions come across my desk and I'm like, yeah, that is a great idea. I know the impact that it will have, but I either was short on capital, you know, monetary capital. I was short on human capital, and healthcare evolves so much. There's so many changes. I was short on, how can I couch it? Basically, relationship capital with my people, giving them one more initiative to take on.
Right.
And so you really have to, you know, as somebody trying to come into a hospital and provide, you know, service or supplies, you really have to be patient. Number one, you have to develop really strong relationships with a couple of the key decision makers early on, identify those, and they change. You know, they're always changing, you know, depending upon what it is. It could be a board level decision. It could be a director level decision. You know, you've got to figure that out. And so, so you've got to be really, you know, as a vendor, as a salesperson, you've got to be really inquisitive and really ask all the right questions. And your next question might be, what are the right questions? It varies. It truly does vary.
And like what we talked about earlier, you know, you're, as an administrator, as an executive at this hospital or this health system, you're also caught between, you know, what are my people asking for? You know, what are my doctors, my physicians, my nurses, what are they asking for? What do they feel like they need to deliver the type of care that they got into this industry to deliver? How much of that decision-making process is driven, you know, from the ground up, grassroots, where you're hearing it from your internal team, and then, you know, that might filter down the options or the solutions that you evaluate from outside?
Oh, it absolutely does. You know, I always tell people I'm the dumbest guy in the room. You know, I had clinicians and other people who were experts in their field, and I would look to them to give me ideas and give me advice. So that's one thing. The other thing is, we went back to choice, right? We were talking about patients have a choice.
Yep.
Employees have a choice. Doctors have a choice. You know, I mean, a doctor could come to me and say, hey, look, I want this new XYZ so that I could do whatever surgery. And I said, you know, I would say, hey, doc, I think it's a great idea. We either, you know, we have to look at what capital are we going to take that from? We're going to look at what's the true market for that in our area. You know, it might be great for a large metropolitan area. It might be great for an academic medical center. It might work, not work in a community hospital that covers, you know, 500,000 up to 1 million people. You know, it might be best to take that somewhere else. Well, what does that doctor do?
Go somewhere else.
He goes to the hospital across the street and says, hey, I'm with the new XYZ. They're trying to buy some business. And they'll say, doc, we'll get you an XYZ today.
Yep. Yep.
All of these decisions are multifaceted. So that's why, and honestly, that's what slows down the decision-making process for vendors is, you know, we've got to consider all of these facets and then weigh that against other priorities.
And that's what, you know, salespeople often miss. And we have a lot of salespeople who watch this podcast, and they're in the heart, you know, they're in the heat of it every day where, you know, they're trying to build these relationships. They're trying to understand executive initiatives and priorities and align, you know, their services and their offering with what's important to that system or that hospital. And oftentimes, you know, it can get boiled down to an economical sell. You know, look, you're spending X on this, or hey, and we're cheaper, or hey, you know, you're only collecting so much of this and we can help you collect more. But at the end of the day, it's so much more than that. It's relationship driven. It's grassroots driven. It's community driven. There's so many layers to this, which is hard to get an understanding of when you're on the outside, like a salesperson typically is.
Yeah. Well, and you just brought up something else too, from the community driven standpoint. You know, hospitals with robust foundations. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a foundation board that encompasses community members, physicians, you know, a wide range of people. They want to bring in technology that's new and innovative that will make a real impact for their community. So that adds another layer of potential decision makers. You know, if you can't find the capital within the organization, then you go to your foundation. And then basically it starts all over again. You've got to sell the foundation members. You've got to, and all that. So, but yeah, I mean, that's an important group too.
It can be a 3-part, 4-part sell. And
at least,
and when you, and when you get to the fourth part, somebody from the first part goes and joins another facility. You got a new decision maker in the first part and the cycle starts all over. It's tough. It's not just tough on the sales, but it's tough on the health system too, the hospital, because they recognize they need some of these things. And that's why people, I really do feel like people give healthcare a bad rap. You know, they feel like innovation and adoption of some new technologies is behind in healthcare. There's really good reasons for that. And you just covered a number of them.
Well, and you know, another industry, and I didn't really realize this until I spent time at the pharmaceutical industry. You know, there's so much talk about, you know, about the cost of drugs, and I get it. I mean, you know, when you start talking about access to care, it's not just to facilities. It's to therapeutics. It's to prescriptions.
Yep.
And a lot of people can afford those. And so, you know, people are saying, well, why does X have to cost so much? It's what you don't see in the background. You know, every drug goes through significant research, development, and testing and all of that. And 99% of those compounds that go through that never make it to market. So pharmaceutical companies have to recoup their costs. How are they going to do that? They're going to do that by increasing prices. And I get it. It's unfortunate, but it does make sense when you look at it as a whole.
It does. And, you know, yeah, this is a touchy subject. This is a hot topic.
Oh, sure it is.
And, and like you, people who are in it and living it every day, we see both sides. Not only does it take a long time to get a drug to market and all the failures are lumped into the cost of doing that business, but they only have a certain amount of time before you know, that drug that they bring to market, that they did all the research for, all the testing for, all the clinical trials for, they only have a limited amount of time to recoup that cost and make some profit before it can be generalized. And so there, it's a race against time on the front end and the back end for these pharmaceutical companies. And look, you know, vaccines are one of those things people are, you know, isn't, they're in the headlines every day. But there are some amazing, amazing innovations in the pharmaceutical and therapeutic space that people depend on every day and are doing great things for the health of our population.
Yeah. Well, and I mentioned the AI too. It's not something to be feared, but it's something to be managed. You know, my last hospital added AI software to two of the MRIs. And, you know, MRI is one of those imaging tests that a lot of people just hate. You know, particularly if you're claustrophobic, if you don't like loud noises, it's a miserable experience. And so what the AI software has done is it's greatly reduced that scan time. Oftentimes, you know, there were some 30-minute scans that we were doing. AI has brought that down to like 5 or 6 minutes. It's a great patient satisfier. But the other thing on top of that are the images are so much more clear.
Accurate.
And it's not, you know, just because they're filling in the gaps, you know. I mean, traditional MRIs, there are certain slices, there are certain speeds and all of that. Well, the AI then brings all that together.
Yep.
And so you've got much better image quality. So you're getting a better diagnostic read. Things like that. And so people have got to, you know, I understand trepidation of people and you know, in various therapeutics and various things. But people need to be open to new technologies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And take full advantage of that.
Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. I had a radiologist tell me one time, you know, call it 20% of images that they detect something. It's not the 20% that keeps a radiologist up at night. It's the 80% that they didn't see anything. The 80%, yeah, they're scared to death that they missed something. Some of these AI technologies are helping, you know, eliminate some of that fear, that concern, that stress of missing out on something. That's just another example of how innovation has taken over. So we've talked about how decisions are made, what has come and go, what stayed the same in these health systems. With so many different priorities, such a limited, you know, budget and brain space, what are some of the non-negotiables, in your opinion, from your perspective, like non-negotiables, things that health systems have to consider and have to evaluate for the health of their business, but also the health of their community, their patients, and then the well-being of their clinicians?
The first and foremost, we're a people business, and our product is taking care of people, and that's taking care of patients. So we need to be able to provide the best quality of care that we can. Sometimes that means not providing that care. Sometimes that means referring that care to a larger institution or an institution elsewhere that does more of those interventions. You know, not every hospital needs to do a heart transplant, right? As an administrator, you need to know your limitations, number one. So that's a non-negotiable, always providing the best level of patient care that you can. Number two, take care of your people. I was fortunate enough early on in my career with a large Catholic system, and this was 25 years ago. We were tasked with being the beta site for this newfangled concept called service excellence. Really? So we went through extensive research, different organizations. We worked with large consulting firms. We worked with small consulting firms. And after about 6 to 8 months of this, it all boiled down to, if you've got an engaged and happy workforce, that's going to lead to more engaged, happier physicians, who will lead to more engaged and happier patients. That first level of customer, if you will, a lot of hospitals will say it's the patient. It's truly your own employee.
Yep.
Making sure that the employees have the resources that they need, appropriate resources, make sure they have updated training, make sure that they have, you know, wellness initiatives, work-life balance initiatives to keep them at their best so they can provide the best care for your patients. Those two, quality patient care and taking care of your employees, to me, David, are the non-negotiables of healthcare.
Where do you see the flow of investments going in the near future for these health systems. You know, if you're talking about patient care and taking care of your people, I'm sure the investments will follow those two areas, but yeah. You know, is it, we've seen it in telehealth. We've seen it with AI. We've seen it in workforce development. In your opinion, if you're looking across the landscape, where's the flow of investments going to be in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years?
Well, I mean, Dave, you've hit on three of those things. I think anything that can provide better efficiencies and better care for the hospital, administrators are going to be investing in that. When you say workforce, it's got to start early. I mean, we're talking middle school age. You know, hospitals and systems have got to start investing in local schools, local education, and really doing a better job of telling the healthcare story to kids who are coming up and are looking at careers. Because, you know, as we said earlier, the healthcare workforce now has been decimated. And we've got to rebuild that. And we've got to come back and we've got to be able to tell a story that makes serving in healthcare honorable again. You know, so many people have seen, you know, so many misuses and of the system, but healthcare is a calling. I mean, I always saw as a calling, David, you know, being able to take care of my fellow man. I mean, I know that's real, you know, pie in the sky, but it meant a lot to me. And I never thought about going to med school at all. I didn't like blood. I didn't like paint. I didn't like needles. I didn't want any of that. I got into healthcare originally. Our Sunday school teacher happened to be the president of a large system in Arkansas when we lived in Little Rock. And he said, I know you're not happy doing what you're doing, because I was selling electronics. I was in an electronics distribution. Crazy start to a healthcare career. He said, I know you're not happy doing what you're doing. Send me a resume. I have no idea what we have. He said, but I know you. I know your work ethic. We might be able to fit you in somewhere. And so 7 weeks later, I basically started the business development function of a freestanding rehabilitation hospital. Rehab was still a very new concept back then. It had only been around about maybe 30-ish years, 40 years, but it was still very new. I basically used what I did selling wiring cables to tell the story and sell, if you will, those rehab referrals, people bringing, you know, physicians referring their patients to us for that.
Yeah.
The first day I was there, they did a great job. They onboarded me well. They had me round with all the therapists, the physicians, everything else. In my first day there, I saw a physical therapist treat somebody who had been in a horrific car accident. Yeah, I was surprised they even made it through. And I'm like, you know what? I'm called to do this work because I can use my business sense to help these people get the care they need.
Yep.
And the cool part of that story was about 8 weeks later, that same person, I watched her walk out of the hospital.
That's awesome.
It's that level of commitment. It's that level of calling. You know, I had an administrator one time say, you know what? You can make a lot more money doing something else, but you're never going to have the personal satisfaction and the impact that you will have if you're in healthcare. And he was right.
It's true. It's true. And, you know, oftentimes on the podcast, I'll ask, you know, not why did you get into healthcare, but why have you stayed? And the stories are very similar to that. You know, there's usually a larger calling, which you talked about generational influence. The generation that is coming into the workforce now and that will be coming into the workforce, they're looking for that higher calling. They're looking.
They really are. Yeah. And that's right.
And they need to understand that no matter what part of healthcare you join and are a part of, you can find that higher calling, and it can be a fulfilling, satisfying career. Whether you're on the fringe like I am, or you know you're Dr. Stevenson, you can find a way to make an impact to a community, to a greater population, and to individuals through the work that you do every day.
David, let me share a story. And you know the story, but I do want to share it again. And I've shared it on I Don't Care. Back earlier this year for Heart Month, February, my hospital decided we're going to drop our CT calcium scoring price from $150 to $39. It's typically not covered by insurance, so this is out of pocket. And it's a quick CT of your chest, you know, to see, you know, what level of plaque that you have in your artery. Mm. I'm going to support my guys. So I sign up, and on February 4th, I had a CT calcium score done. And pretty soon thereafter, I get a call from my head of radiology, said, "Hey, can you come up to my office real quick?" I said, "Oh boy, okay." So I go up there and he tells me, he said, your score is bad. It's really bad. I'd had a couple before. They hadn't been great. I was treating them pharmacologically. They felt fine. Didn't have any real symptoms. Was a little tired, but I'm thinking, you know, I'm older. I'm a little tired. And so he said, "You know, you need to do something about this quickly." And so, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have my cardiologist on my cell. You know, I've got a cell number. And so I texted him. I said, "Hey, here's my number." He calls me that night and says, "You know what? I really want to look at, I want to go in." And so he ended up going in. I go into the cath lab, you know, a few days later, I come out with 4 stents.
Man.
And 2 in the right coronary and 2 in the circumflex. And he said, you know, 1 was 90%, 1 was 75. I didn't know that. I had no idea. I had, like I said, a little tired. That was about it.
Right.
So that was on a Friday. So Sunday, I'm going to church, go to Sunday school. And I had said something to my Sunday school director before, "Hey, I'm going in for a cap," you know, all this other stuff. And he said, "Hey, would you mind talking to the department about?" I said, "Yeah, I'd be glad to." And it's an older department, you know, 60s, 70s and up. And so I just told him my story. I said, "Guys, you know, I don't care if you do it at my hospital or if you do it at our competing hospital down the street. So, but get this done." I said, "Because this is an important test. It's an easy test. And it really gives you a lot of good information that can tell you, hey, you know, this, you need to do X, Y, or Z." By doing that, I've honestly lost count of the number of people who have come up to me and said, "Hey, thank you for that. You saved my life." I ended up going and having a cath. I ended up having stents. A couple of people had open heart surgery. But the other part of the CT calcium score is it's in the box, right? It's in the upper torso. And so not only does that find plaque, but it'll also find lung nodules. It'll find a triple A. It'll find breast cancer. We found those too. You ask why I stay in healthcare, that's why.
Yep.
Because one simple story can blow up and help a whole lot of people. You know, one intervention, one preventative test can help a whole lot of people.
That's exactly right.
And those of us who have been doing this for a long time, that's why we're here.
That's why we're here. And that's why we'll keep being here. Those are the stories that the younger generation need to hear, because, I mean, you could go your whole life in a different career, different industry, and not have a story like that. And that stuff happens every day in healthcare. All right. I've got a lightning round for you.
Oh, good.
All right. We've talked about some things that vendors need to start doing. We've talked about non-negotiables for health systems and hospitals. What's one thing systems need to stop doing?
Focusing solely on the numbers. Hey, I get it. I had a nun years ago take my face in her hands and said, "Kevin, always remember no margin, no mission." I get it. We've got to make money. There's got to be money for, you know, to pay your folks. There's got to be money for new capital. There's got to be money for facility upgrades. But you can't solely focus on the numbers. You've got to remember this is when you strip it all away, this is about people.
Yeah.
You can't forget about the people.
I agree with that. All right. Last one. What's a leadership lesson you wish you knew 20 years ago?
I think honestly, admitting that you're not the smartest person in the room and really it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to ask for help and advice.
Yeah.
Just because you have chief in front of your title or vice or whatever, executive or president in front of your title, doesn't mean you have all the answers. Oftentimes, the best answers come from, hey, your housekeeping staff, your dietary staff, your nurses, your techs. They're the ones that are having to deal with the problems on a day-to-day basis. And it's your job to work with them and to listen to them and help them do their jobs better. So I would just say listening a lot better to everybody and not thinking that you have to have all the answers yourself.
That's why you hired them, right?
Yeah, right.
So very well done. Very well said. Any questions, anything that you'd like to ask? You have anything you want to throw my way?
I can't think of anything. You know, I just appreciate all that you do. You know, again, you're out there doing what I said. You're out there telling the healthcare story. It's a great story, right? I mean, it's a fantastic story. but it needs to be told over and over and over again.
Yep.
You know, the impact on healthcare, it impacts every person on this planet, you know? And so that story needs to be told. So number one, people can take better care of themselves so that we can have more engaged and called people providing the care. And so that we can, you know, frankly, help generate income and capital for vendors and all of those ancillary services that are attached to healthcare.
Yep.
So just keep doing that. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And thank you for being here. It's been fun to learn from you. If you're listening, I call Dr. Stevenson a friend. And it's because we're aligned in a lot of ways. And for those out there, you know, the call to action would be if you're looking for something fulfilling, look into healthcare. If you're looking to sell to hospitals and health systems, learn more about them. Be interested and not interesting. And understand that it's going to take some time. It's going to take some sweat equity. It's not because of you. It's because of the industry and the nature of how this thing works. And just keep at it. But Dr. Stevenson, thank you for being here. And we'll talk soon.
Thanks, David. Great to be with you. Really enjoyed it.